This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. 2 weeks after millions of Iraqis cast their first free votes in over 50 years, the results are now in. A coalition of Shiite Islamic parties won 48% of the vote, and that is less than the 60% expected. Since a two-thirds majority is needed to form a government, the coalition, dominated by the United Iraqi Alliance, will need the support of other parties in order to govern as a majority. The United Iraqi Alliance is headed by two religious Shiite parties, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq and Dawah. It has close ties, both parties, to its neighbors in Iran. In other results, a coalition of two Kurdish parties won nearly 26% of the vote, while Sunni Arab parties, as expected, won only a fraction of that vote. So what does it mean for the future of Iraq? How will the majority Shias, repressed for decades under Saddam Hussein, work with the Sunnis, the Kurds, the Turkmen, and other minority groups to govern that country? And what role will Islam play in forming a new legal system? What's the next step for this new Iraqi government? Call in with your questions. We'd especially like to hear from Iraqi listeners who voted in this country, in the United States. What's your reaction to the election outcome? And what do you want to see happen next? Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. We start first in Baghdad with Doug Strzok, foreign reporter for The Washington Post, who's joining us now. Doug, thanks very much. I know it's late where you are.
It's a little bit late, but good morning to you, Frank.
Good afternoon and good evening wherever you are. Slim margin captured by the Shiite alliance. That was less than hoped for by Shia groups. What do you think happened?
Well, it was a little bit less than they predicted in the immediate aftermath of the voting, although before the election they were downplaying expectations and were talking about 35, 40, 45%. In fact, they got 48%, which is pretty respectable. It's just that right after the balloting on January 30th, there was a flush of enthusiasm, and some of the Shiite groups predicted that they would get over 50 to 60%. So I don't think you could count this as a loss for them, but it certainly means that they're going to have to do some wheeling and dealing in the back rooms, which is going on as we speak, to try to get the votes necessary they need to get the aims that they want.
I guess the other thing is that without having a free vote in 50 years or so, it's a little hard to apply the rules of political punditry to exit polls and figuring out how people voted and why.
Well, that's true. And, of course, you had this big wild card, which was that a major segment of the population here, that is the Sunni Arabs, were advised to boycott the election by their leaders and were threatened not to vote by the insurgency. So, we didn't know really until the day of election how much of an effect that would be. As it turns out, both of those factors did repress the Sunni vote considerably. So that was a large chunk of the population that just sort of dropped out of the counting. And as expected, the Shias in the south and the Kurds in the north went to the polls in great numbers. So it sort of skewed the whole results.
Tell us more about the two Shia parties, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq and Dawah.
Well, they are indeed two parties, although they ran as a unified list, and it is that unified list that got 48% of the vote. Now, the question is, will the unity be able to continue once they start hashing out who's going to get what jobs in the new government? As I say, that's going on as we speak. There's secret meetings going on here in Baghdad in which we assume that the horse trading is hot and heavy. And the question will be primarily focused on the top post, that is the prime minister's job.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably the up for the taking by the Shiite list. The question is, does Dawah get it, or does Skiri get it, or does some compromise candidate get it?
Well, what distinguishes the parties? Is there much of it from our vantage point, the United States? We're looking at Shiite parties. We're assuming some religious connection, but clearly there's a distinction.
Well, there is. Dawah is actually more of a homegrown party in Iraq. They were indigenous to Iraq and were severely repressed under Saddam Hussein. Whole families were executed, wiped out, simply for being members of the Dawa Party or even alleged members of the Dawa Party. So it was quite an oppressed party, and its leader, Ibrahim Jaafari, moved over to Iran in 1980. He fled Iraq. The other main party, and actually the larger party, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which we call SCIRI, was actually formed in Iran and operated in Iran with a very strong and somewhat feared militia that was opposed to Saddam Hussein on the borders. So they're sort of more of an Iranian-grown group, but they are actually the larger and more powerful. Their candidate for prime minister is a fellow named Adel Abdel Mahdi. Both he and Jaafari appear to be rather secular religious Shiites, if you excuse the contradiction of terms. Both of them appear in Western dress and are well-spoken and can represent Iraq quite well in sort of Western councils of power. What concerns some viewers and certainly concerns a lot of Iraqis is that behind them is the turban religious Shia members of their parties, which who have very close ties to Iran.
All right. Well, Doug, I appreciate this. Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Doug Strzok is a foreign reporter for The Washington Post and spoke with us from his office in Baghdad. Joining us now for the discussion of what these election results mean and what some of the other parties may mean and the role they'll play in the future of Iraq is Larry Diamond. He's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He was also an advisor to Paul Bremer and the U.S. Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad at this time last year. Larry, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Frank.
What do you make of the election results?
Well, you know, there's a distinction between the day of and the day after. The day of was deeply moving, profoundly historic, phenomenal in many respects. The emotion, the passion, the conviction, the defiance, the courage with which people voted. All of that needs to be acknowledged and not forgotten. But now comes the sobriety as we see that the election really was what many of us anticipated it would be with the electoral system that was used and with the extremely shallow nature of the campaign, where most parties and candidates could not get out, could not move around the country, and had absolutely no money to buy media time, or they were not given any free access to the media to promote their program and their identities. As a result, the election was an identity referendum. 70%, I estimate, of Shia voted for the United Iraqi Alliance. Almost all the Kurds voted for the Kurdistan Alliance, or another small Kurdish party, and they voted in overwhelming numbers, over 80% turnout in Kurdistan. And 80% or so, one could estimate, of Sunnis didn't vote. It was their way of expressing their opinion. So the country is today significantly more polarized and divided than it was 3 weeks ago.
And you expect these divisions then to play out as the next phase unfolds?
I fear that they will. I think that there is now a very heavy burden on the political leaders of the Kurdistan Alliance, but even more so of the United Iraqi Alliance, to reach out, to compromise, and most of all, to bring in not just Sunnis, because it's clear that the United Iraqi Alliance-led government, if it's Adel Mahdi as prime minister, if it's Ibrahim Jaafari as prime minister, or whoever, they've said they're going to reach out and bring in Sunnis. The question is, which Sunnis? Are they going to be Sunnis with weak or no constituencies who will be, you know, easy for the alliance to deal with? Or are they going to be Sunnis who have been chosen to be the representatives and spokespersons of genuine tribal religious and political constituencies in the Sunni heartland? Unless it's the latter, I think we're in for real problems.
Well, let me take you back one step, Larry, and ask you if the voters in this election had that choice to begin with, given what happened in the immediate aftermath of the U.S. invasion. I mean, was the deck cleared? Were Iraqi voters given the full slate of candidates, or were they given a select set that were appealing in many ways to the United States?
No, I think it's well known that very few of the names of the candidates were known to the voters. They were kept secret for the a very good reason, and that is that people feared retaliation. If their names were known, some people could have been assassinated. So people really didn't have a very good sense of what the choices were and who and what they were voting for. And as a result, as I said, the election became an identity referendum, or what Donald Horowitz calls in his famous book, Ethnic Groups in Conflict, an ethnic census.
So give us an idea of what happens next. This is, of the vote last month, was for a 275-member parliament. This is not for prime minister or president. Where are we in the process?
Where we are now is that the elected members of the 275-member National Assembly will meet probably before the end of the month. Their first act will be to organize themselves as a parliament and choose leaders. Then they will elect a presidency council, a three-member presidency council, which must be elected by a two-thirds vote as a slate. Then they will choose a prime minister who will be formally nominated by the presidency council and who must get a vote of confidence from the parliament. All of this will be worked out as part of a grand compromise or bargain.
All right. Larry Diamond is my guest this hour, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. We are talking about Iraq's elections, the aftermath of this first stage in the shift to democracy, Shiite politics, what it may mean for the region. Taking a short break right now, but we will take your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can send us an email at totn@npr.org. I'm Frank Stasio. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stasio in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. We're talking about Iraq's future with Larry Diamond, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, and taking your calls at 800-989-TALK, our email address, totn@npr.org. Larry, what effect do you think the outcome will have on the insurgency?
I think that the insurgency now may very well not only persist but intensify, unless there is, and there could be, and I really pray there will be, a concerted, intelligent, patient, and fairly open-ended effort to reach out to the Sunni constituency. Again, I want to stress, not just to name Sunnis to the cabinet and the Constitution Drafting Committee, but to sit down with chosen representatives of these communities. They have an alliance. They met in Tikrit. They've selected, you know, negotiators and spokespersons. Sit down with those people and see what can be worked out in terms of broadening the government, broadening the Constitution Drafting Committee.
With a 60% majority in population, does the Shiite coalition have any real incentive to do that?
I think the incentive they have, if they're really thinking about it, is that if they don't do that, they're going to have won something of a Pyrrhic victory, because the country's just going to burn, you know, at something like the current level of intensity, if not worse. Now, whether they recognize that, whether they see that, the new elected leadership, I think is probably the single most important question facing Iraq now.
Let's go to the phones. Majid is on the phone from Philadelphia. Hello, Majid. Did I get that right?
It's Majid, actually.
Majid. Go ahead.
I was interested in listening to your show this afternoon. I was born in Mosul, in the north, from in a Sunni family, and I was very happy to vote a couple of weeks ago in Washington, and support the other people that voted in Iraq.
How do you feel about the outcome?
Well, I'm not too surprised. I think it's encouraging that there was something like a more than 20% turnout in Mosul, kind of the heartland of the Sunni community, in spite of the threats of by the insurgents against anyone that would vote. I had emails and phone calls from cousins there that were, they were elated that people were coming out and voting by the, you know, thousands and thousands of people, and in spite of the threats. So it was courageous. It was something very positive. The other positive news I've been getting over the last few weeks is that both the Iraqi police and the multinational forces are cracking down on the insurgents much more so than they were in prior months. And people feel that security is getting somewhat better. And that's the first I've heard that in 8 months' time.
That part is interesting. But let me ask you this now, Majid, about something Larry Diamond said regarding the ability or willingness of the majority now to reach out to credible Sunni candidates, to those with a real constituency. First of all, do you have any sense of who those candidates might be and whether or not the folks in Mosul and other areas, Sunni areas, or other Sunnis, believe that that's what's happening or what's about to happen?
Well, I think some of the leaders that have emerged in the last year, like the interim president, Eliaour, I think is seen as someone that can speak for many people in Mosul. Others like Adnan Pachici, who also was running in the election, I think is credible amongst many in the Sunni community. Even though he didn't receive that many votes, I think he's respected and seen as independent and wanting what's good for the future of Iraq. I'm cautiously optimistic. I don't foresee that the Shia in the south are going to try to force their will on all of Iraq. I think it's very encouraging that the insurgents have been trying their best to foment strife between the different ethnic and religious groups by their bombings and attacks, and that has not happened, in spite of bombing mosques and killing other religious leaders. They have not been able to start a conflict amongst the groups. So I'm cautiously optimistic.
All right, Majid, thank you very much for your call. Larry Diamond, is there reason to be optimistic, the fact that there does seem to be a more concerted effort to crack down on the insurgents and perhaps more optimism that democracy can take hold?
I personally think that more vigorous policing, intelligence, and military efforts against the insurgency are certainly necessary. One reason among many why I think we saw relatively less violence on election day is that we did have a surge in the number of American troops. We've never had enough troops there to secure the situation. Obviously, in the end, it's really going to rely on Iraqi troops and security forces. But that's an element. The problem is it's not adequate as an element. And if it's not coupled with the political element I was talking about, in itself, I think at best it's going to kind of contain the insurgency to a certain still very potent level.
To what extent, though, does the American presence there, particularly in these numbers, give the new Iraqi leadership a false sense of security, a sense that they can continue to play the politics of division because there is this strong force there?
Well, this is very much a two-edged sword, Frank, because I think you may see this new government, which is a pretty nationalist government, pushing the U.S. for a timetable for withdrawal. And really trying to build up their forces in a variety of ways. And I think we may see them, if they get more desperate, leaning on Iran for more security assistance. And we may well see, in fact, I anticipate that we will see stepped up infiltration of Iranian intelligence and militia type elements into the country. I think that we need negotiations. The security element is not going to be enough. If I can note one more positive thing, I think many of the Sunnis realize that they miscalculated very badly by organizing this boycott. They basically disenfranchised themselves. And I think it's not going to happen in the next election. And that's a positive sign. There is now a strong kind of intellectual and political recognition among many Sunnis, including some who've sympathized with the insurgency, that they need to come into the political process.
800-989-8255 is the number to call if you want to join our conversation. And Shazeb is on the line from Davis, California. Shazeb?
Hi.
Hi.
How's it going?
Good.
Yeah, well, I have a couple of comments, actually. First off, I just wanted to propound the issue of whether a weak democracy, which in my eyes is what we have in Iraq now, is it better than having no democracy at all? Because it seems that you had these elections, but in many ways the elections were just symbolic, and they weren't very much past that. In a sense, it was just a superficial ceremonious thing, and it seems that there are many aspects to democracy that we have yet to be seen in Iraq. And the other issue I wanted to bring up was about Islam being compatible with democracy. Now, I think a lot of people seem to have this misconception about Islam, that Islam is completely opposed to democratic principles and democratic viewpoints. But the fact of the matter is, if you look in history, and I'm talking about past recent history, you see that Islam is fully compatible with Islam. In fact, the idea of democracy, which promotes the well-being of people, is at the essence of Islamic principles. So it seems that oftentimes when people hear about Islamic parties, they immediately have this negative connotation, and especially people in the West, they think Islam, an Islamic party, well, that immediately means terrorism, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an incredible misconception. And in fact, if you suppress religion, it's going to be a problem, because religion is at the core of many of these people's lives and beliefs.
Well, let me get a response to that, and thank you for your call, Shazeb. I appreciate it. Larry, the first one first, is a weak democracy worse than no democracy at all at this delicate stage?
I think that's the wrong way to frame it, Frank. I think the question is the timing of elections, and particularly of national elections. Many of us feel that we should have had direct local and provincial elections much earlier to call forth a variety of, sort of indigenously vetted and endorsed local leaderships that might have generated a more pluralistic situation, focused more on individuals rather than ethnic symbols. But that aside, what's the alternative? I think the alternative, we need to think carefully about the type of democracy and the timing of elections. But I think it's an illusion to think that there's some benign authoritarian alternative out there. I don't think there is. And I think the only way that Iraq is going to move forward and manage its deep ethnic and religious divisions now is with some type of democratic government, but it has to be inclusive, it has to be well-structured, and it has to emphasize accommodation.
What about the influence of religion and Islam on the development of the new constitution, the legal code?
The caller had some very good points. I think that I agree that there's no intrinsic difficulty or intrinsic contradiction between Islam and democracy, and that it's very much a matter of interpretation. Many Iraqis and others are arguing now in a variety of interesting and creative ways, intellectually and philosophically and spiritually, that Islam and democracy can and should be compatible. The problem is that the view of democracy among many of the Shiite Islamists in the United Iraqi Alliance, I think we're going to see evidence of this unfold over time, maybe not quite so much initially, is a very majoritarian view. And it's not just a question of democracy, because democracy can be structured in different ways. It's a question of whether these Islamist-leaning political actors will have a view of democracy that is sufficiently accommodating of minority rights, devolution of power, and power sharing. I think only that type of democracy can really achieve political stability and progress in Iraq.
All right, Larry. Well, I know you have to go, so I thank you very much for joining us. Okay. Larry Diamond is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He was an advisor to the U.S. Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad, and he spoke with us from his office in Stanford, California. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Frank Stachow, sitting in for Neil Conan. We are going to talk more about the Shias in Iraq and a little more about this new constitution and what effect Islam will play in forming the new legal code, and also the business of diversity and bringing in minority groups. Here to talk with us is Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle Eastern history at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy Wars, The Politics, Culture, and History of Shiite Islam. Welcome, Juan.
Thank you.
How much will the Shias, do you think, reach out to the Sunnis to bring them into government? You heard Larry Diamond talk about not just simply reaching out to those who are Sunni, but those with a credible constituency.
Well, I think there's every evidence that you're dealing here in the Shiites with a mature political class. These are people who have been in heavy-duty politics for decades. They were chased out of Iraq by Saddam because they were involved in that kind of politics. And they saw how politics in Iran went bad under an authoritarian clerical regime. And so I think, you know, the noises they're making are that they would like very much to reach out to the Kurds and the Sunni Arabs, and they want a united Iraq.
And the other thing I suppose to keep in mind is that there was more or less an advanced middle class in Iraq at one point, and this does distinguish it in some ways from other Arab and Islamic countries right now in the region.
Well, that's right. There is a substantial educated middle class. The ravages of the 1990s wrought a lot of damage on it, but it's still there, and a lot of these people come from it. The other thing to remember is that Iraqi nationalism, although it's a relatively young phenomenon, maybe 80 years old, is nevertheless very powerful. And among the major political parties in Iraq, all of them, I think, would like to have an influence on the country. And none of them want a kind of moth-eaten Iraq. They don't want the Shiites in particular say, you know, we've been out of power for 80 years despite being a majority. When we finally take over the country, we don't want it to be broken up and for us not to get the whole thing.
Should the Sunnis be concerned about what rights they'll have in this government?
Well, this is the real problem, that the Sunni Arabs had been the ruling class in Iraq. They were a kind of class/sect, and you know, you could compare them to the whites of South Africa under apartheid. It wasn't quite that draconian, and especially it wasn't enshrined in law, but as the country really worked, that was kind of the situation. The Shiites in the south were marginalized, the Kurds in the north were marginalized, the Sunni Arabs of the center north got the lion's share of good jobs and managerial jobs and officer corps and petroleum income. And they have to get used to being 20% of the population, maybe less, and to being a minority. And the guerrilla war that's being fought by people who refuse to get used to that idea.
All right, let's go to the phones again. And we'll take a call now from Paul. And Paul is joining us from Boise, Idaho. Hello, Paul.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm interested in the professor's understanding of what the current administration in the White House will do now, knowing that the election really didn't turn out the way they wanted it for Sistani. And I'd like just to know his thoughts on that and what the Jesuits who back the administration are going to do next.
Okay. What do you think? Is this something that the Bush administration wanted to see, Professor Cole?
Well, the Bush administration goals in Iraq have all along contained an essential contradiction. On the one hand, they said that they were liberating Iraq and would like to see a democratic regime there. On the other, it was very clear that they had their own goals in Iraq and wanted to accomplish those goals by pretty heavy-handed American influence. And so among the first things they did was to try to dismantle the Arab socialist economic policies of the Ba'ath Party, and to have a kind of Polish-style shock therapy of economic liberalization. Of course, they also would like Iraq to develop as a military ally of the United States and the region and be a base for U.S. operations, including possibly against Iran. So those goals aren't compatible with Iraqi self-determination because the Shiite majority in Iraq doesn't want those things. They think tolerant a form of socialism, and they also have warm relations with Shiite Iran.
All right, Juan Cole, well, we will finish our conversation with you about the future of Iraq. Plus, the original DNA doodle goes online. We'll take your letters. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're wrapping up our discussion about the Iraqi election and the aftermath. Still with us is Juan Cole, the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Politics, Culture, and History of Shiite Islam. Juan Cole, you talked about the strong sense of nationalism and emerging sense of nationalism in Iraq. Still, Iran has its influence with the parties that are now part of that coalition. What will be the relationship between Iraq and Iran, and what will be Iran's influence?
Well, Iran is the place that many of the Shiite political groups escaped to from the persecution of Saddam Hussein, and they used Iran as a base to strike at the Ba'athist regime. The Ba'athists would have considered them terrorists. And so they had excellent relations with the regime in Tehran, relations that continue to be good to this day. During the past 2 years, most American press outlets haven't reflected the fact, but the leaders of the Dawah Party, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, and other groups have gone off to see the politicians in Tehran quite regularly and have had good relations with them so far. I expect that to continue.
And that can't be comforting for the United States.
Well, the United States, again, you know, the Bush administration policies towards Iraq are contradictory. At some times, the United States has said that it expects, you know, that Iraq would have to live in the neighborhood and have good relations with its neighbors. On the other hand, I think where the United States wants to put pressure on a country like Iran, the good relations between Baghdad and Tehran might become an obstacle.
800-989-8255 is the number to call if you want to join our conversation. Cyril is on the line from Blackfoot, Idaho. Hello, Cyril.
How are you?
Good.
I had a question about the economic future of Iraq and where the professor thought that was headed. I understand that before Paul Bremer handed over the authority to the temporary government, that he, you know, rewrote the tax code, kind of restructured the laws to make it more friendly to privatization. I was wondering if you think Iraqis are going to embrace a free market economy, or if you think they might try to implement some kind of alternative or mixed economy.
Thanks, Cyril.
Well, it's certainly the case that the U.S. administration in Iraq has tried to effect something like a Polish-style shock therapy and to pursue economic liberalization. The opinion polls show that the majority of Iraqis, over 80%, feel that the government is there to take care of them. And so the mood in the country tends to be rather socialist. And it's difficult to see how extensive privatization and moving away from government programs could possibly be popular in a country like Iraq in the foreseeable future with the high unemployment and all of the problems. So I personally don't expect Mr. Bremer's laissez-faire laws to survive very long.
Do you think, and I'm posing Larry Diamond's proposal to you to get your take on this, the idea that the coalition now really needs to reach out and that it's in their best interest, do you think they need to see it that way? Or if this really was a sort of an identity referendum that people voted for, the parties or the ethnic groups they're a member of, do those parties have to remain faithful, and do they see their future in holding on to division?
Well, I think Larry Diamond, who was on the scene and is a keen observer, is perfectly correct that if the parties act now as political actors as though they only represent their constituents, then we're in for a lot of trouble in Iraq. But if, having been elected, they now move to behaving as one does in a parliamentary system, trading horses and bargaining and making compromises in order to get legislation through, then that's hopeful. And I think, you know, it's a good sign that the United Iraqi Alliance will need the Kurds to form a government. You need 66%. The final tally for the Shiites is probably 51%. So they can do a lot of things in parliament without consulting anyone else, but they do need the Kurds or some large block of votes like that to form a government, and that means that they'll have to make compromises.
Okay, let's go to Hollywood, Florida. Max is on the line. Hello, Max. Max, are you there?
Hello.
Hi.
Frank?
Yeah.
Good afternoon, Frank. Just a point. You've been quoting the number 48 and 26%. I'm only noticing you're leaving out another 26%, and the number that out there is still unaccounted for. I'm thinking the Shiites could get some more portions based on how much arse trading goes around.
Yes, that's perfectly correct. That is to say, first of all, this election and its results are being done by a complicated system. And so the results that were announced on Sunday are only initial results, and they are revised. And the small parties that didn't get enough votes to get seated, their proportion of the seats will be actually redistributed to the ones that won, to the list that won. So the final tally, according to the Arab Satellite News today, is 51% for the United Iraqi Alliance, the Shiite fundamentalist parties. And in addition to which, three seats went to the Sadr movement, which is a hardline Shiite group, and a couple other Shiite independents seem to have gotten seats. So I would say that the United Iraqi Alliance, if it can keep together and maintain list discipline, really is in a position to set the procedural rules for Parliament and to accomplish a lot just on its own. It doesn't need other people.
All right, Juan, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Juan Cole is a professor of modern Middle Eastern history at the University of Michigan. He's also author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Politics, Culture, and History of Shiite Islam. He spoke with us from his office in Ann Arbor.